On RN Summer, Joe Gelonesi with you for the Philosopher's Zone. Today, a conversation that stirred quite a response when we first aired it, on the idea of plant thinking.
Ancient Greeks did not have a word specific for plants. They called plants phutoi, which were growing beings. But of course, both animals and humans are also growing beings. To recognize the other in plants is also to recognize this vegetal other in us.
Coming closer to home, plants have been at the bottom of the philosophical heap for a long time. But today's ecological threats are forcing a new assessment. Michael Marder is a philosopher of vegetal life. He believes that looking at plants differently might just bring our own way of thinking back to its roots. Michael Marder, what brought you to consider a philosophy of vegetal life?
Well, it was actually an interesting set of coincidences. One evening in 2008, I was in the winter next to a fireplace in the north of Portugal in a very beautiful region called Gerês. That region, for those who don't know, is actually an amazing national park with a sort of enchanted forest. And so having been impressed by this forest, I was reading a work on Aristotle. And I started considering again this idea of the vegetal soul or the vegetative soul that Aristotle advances. And it occurred to me that very little has been said about it actually in contemporary philosophy. It's as if from our anthropocentric paradigm, our focus on the human soul, we have managed to take an extra step to the animal soul or to animal subjectivity, if you will. But criticism has stopped there. So I think it was those two things, reading this book on Aristotle and having had the experience of this majestic forest in the north of Portugal, made me consider the exclusion of vegetal soul or the vegetal subjectivity from contemporary philosophical discourses.
How does Aristotle approach vegetal life or a vegetal existence?
Well, he approaches it actually rather reductively. So he doesn't have too much to say about it, but he does say that plants have certain functions that they do perform, such as they obtain nourishment, they reproduce. And what is interesting, I think, is that he thinks this is the most common level of the soul, a soul that is actually common to all living beings. And to be alive is to be capable of being nourished and of reproducing and of growing. So Aristotle thinks that the capacities of plants end there, and then animal and human capacities are superadded onto this most basic stratum or level of the soul. So he certainly doesn't think that plants are capable of sensing, experiencing, let alone thinking about anything. All they can do is reproduce and obtain nourishment and grow.
I want to come back to this idea of nourishment and growth because it's kind of central to your thesis. But just you mentioned animals there. In recent times, obviously, philosophers like Peter Singer have brought great attention to animal ethics. Do you think their insights have prefigured a new form of thinking around plants?
Yes, I think that those studies were actually groundbreaking because probably 40, 50 years ago, no one would have thought about the idea of animal ethics or kind of an ethical approach to animals in the Western tradition. It's also very important to keep in mind the context of this because in non-Western traditions, respect for all sorts of life has been a priority for thousands of years. And in the West, we unfortunately fell into a kind of very narrow-minded humanistic paradigm where whenever we spoke about ethics, morality, respect, the only respectable thing, if you will, or agent would have been a human being, and not even the whole of the human being, but only the rational part of the human, as Kant, for instance, claimed. For Kant, there is nothing respectable about humans insofar as they have these concrete needs of eating and all of those bodily needs that we're aware of. The only thing worthy of respect is the fact that we can reason, can talk to one another and find a common ground. And so this attention that was paid to animals and now hopefully also to plants also broadens the scope of respect and of ethics in the Western context insofar as we can maybe finally learn to respect something about ourselves, which is our material and bodily constitution, which philosophers have either ignored or simply denigrated for a long time now in the West.
And yet, to enlarge that circle, you'd have to get past the idea that plants are secretive, they're silent, they're obdurate, they're wholly inscrutable, not like animals, and particularly pets, which seem to be part of, you know, humans' lives. What do you mean by plant thinking in this regard?
Right. You are right to point out the fact that from our human standpoint, plants are particularly unresponsive. We can certainly monitor objective outcomes of the care we put into growing plants, for instance. If you water a plant and tend it and give it fertilizer, you can see how rapidly it grows or whether it flourishes or not. But the interaction sort of stops there in many ways. There are people, of course, who insist on talking to plants, on playing classical music to them to encourage their growth. But on the objective level, they are silent in this sense. So to talk about plant thinking is in a way to broaden the category of thinking as well, the category of consciousness. In other words, thinking does not need to be limited to abstract representations that we form, to the words that we use to call things by their names. But perhaps we can think about thinking in a more basic, more elementary way as a kind of consciousness of one's surroundings, awareness of one's surroundings, and the way of acting upon one's environment and being acted upon it in turn. So that, for instance, in phenomenology, one of the schools of 20th century philosophy that I specialize in as well, consciousness is defined as directedness toward. When as soon as I direct myself toward something, let's say this cup of water, I'm conscious of it. And clearly, plants can direct themselves to all kinds of things. They are directed toward the sunlight. Their roots are directed to the minerals and moisture that they seek in the soil. So in that sense, plants exhibit a basic level of consciousness and satisfy the phenomenological definition of consciousness in this sense.
It satisfies it, and yet it would seem, in common sense terms, that that is a minimum level of consciousness. The idea that, you know, they seek nourishment, they grow, they seek the sun. There is something in that which, whether we like it or not, we tend to feel is hierarchically down the order of existence, and probably why we find it difficult to ascribe interests or some kind of moral realm to plants.
Yes, certainly. At the same time, however, seeking nutrients, for instance, is not as straightforward as we think. Plants, as botanists nowadays have recognized, navigate extremely complex underground labyrinths in search of the optimal, best places where they can obtain the most moisture and nourishment. So the behavior of roots, for instance, has been compared to the behavior of rodents in a labyrinth, insofar as they find the optimal, the best path toward a place or a spot with the most resources. So there is a kind of complex calculation that goes into this activity of searching for nourishment. For instance, a botanist from the University of Edinburgh, Anthony Trevovas, pointed out plants are aware at any given time of at least 15 environmental factors. And if you consider all the combinations of those 15 factors, then it's a very complex task indeed to balance them all out and to take them all into account, which is what plants manage to do by integrating signals coming from all kinds of directions and all sources.
Ironically, we know this information via scientific work and scientific classification to some degree, and being able to use our own rationalistic and scientific methods to work out what plants are up to. And yet, part of plant thinking, as you see it, needs to loosen those bonds of science and botany and classification to let plants be. That is an irony, isn't it?
Yes, there is something ironic about it, but at the same time, science is not a homogeneous edifice that we can talk about in as a kind of general term. Within contemporary botany, there is a very intense debate raging nowadays between the proponents of plant intelligence studies and those who think that plants are not intelligent beings, that they can be studied in an objective way that science usually pursues. So there is a kind of unevenness in scientific paradigms, I would say here. Perhaps we're even witnessing the birth of a new scientific paradigm in botany, where plants are not considered only as objects, but as subjects in their own right, as active agents in their milieu, beings with interests of their own and with a good of their own. So it would be too simplistic to talk about science dismissively, especially to talk about it dismissively as if it were a uniform, homogeneous endeavor. On the other hand, yes, I do agree that we letting plants be invites a kind of non-scientific attitude, which I would call broadly contemplative or even aesthetic. So that I claim in plant thinking that perhaps it is through art that we are able to or manage to be at peace with plants, where we do not interfere with them, where we observe them from a distance or represent them on a canvas, for instance. In that way, do not instrumentalize them, do not turn them into means for our own ends.
So does that mean we need to allow the plant to have its secret life?
Yes, absolutely. And much of it actually does not depend on us. As botanists will tell us, we know very little, actually, surprisingly little about plants. And this is why it's so exciting, all of these new developments in botany. They are just scratching the surface of something that we are barely aware of. Of course, in science, usually there is a kind of optimism where even if we do not know something at this point in time, after rigorous application of the scientific procedure and after in due time, we are going to learn everything there is to know about an object of knowledge. This is what sets a scientific paradigm apart from the philosophical one. In philosophy, we rather raise questions and we problematize what is known, as opposed to trying to get to know everything there is to be known about a plant, for instance. And that is why I do rely on some of the scientific findings from contemporary botany, but at the same time, I want to stay faithful to my vocation, which is philosophy, and to continue asking seemingly trivial question, what is a plant? All of us take this for granted, but this question needs to be raised, and it is not at all clear that we can respond to it in a kind of definitive way.
It is an interesting problematic to set up. One which I find hard to conceive of is the notion of the non-conscious intention or non-conscious intentionality, which I think you talk about in regards to plants. Tell me, how do you conceive of that in plant life?
Yes, perhaps what would help is would be actually an example from human life. Much of our intentionality is non-conscious, so that our bodies have an intentionality of their own, of which we are not aware. When I stretch my hand to grasp a pen, for instance, I do not think about the act itself. The body, after having learned a certain habitual routine, has an intentionality of its own and functions in the world in a vast majority of cases without me actually making conscious representation of that action. And I would argue that in the case of plants, this is the kind of intentionality we are dealing with. When they do stretch up toward the light of the sun, they exhibit this kind of a non-conscious intentionality. At the same time, however, they do have elements of what we could call deliberation or decision-making. For instance, decisions on flowering time are very complex and they depend on many different factors, from external temperature to the length of a day and so on, that plants have to juggle at the same time until they actually come to this decision to blossom.
Michael Marder, philosopher of vegetal life, and you're listening to him on the Philosopher's Zone on RN.
Is it coincidence that a plant will grow its petals into an exact replica of a female bee?
The idea of plant sentience has ebbed and flowed, popularised in books, films and TV programmes.
So alluring to the male bee that he attempts to mate with the petal and in so doing pollinates the orchid.
Always conceived of as a secret, silent, unyielding and inscrutable. But perhaps plants are more knowable with a slight tweak to how we think about thinking. Just taking this further then, you talk about when we conceive of the idea of a plant life or plant thinking, that it's put in the terms it thinks rather than I think. Can you please draw out that distinction for me. It thinks rather than I think.
Yes, what I mean by it thinks is a kind of anonymity in thinking. And again, an example that would be closer to us would be the unconscious. So that in the beginning of the 20th century, Sigmund Freud postulated that we are not wholly conscious beings. In fact, there is a vast region, psychic region of the unconscious that governs many of our actions, desires, behaviors, and so on. This unconscious level is not really personalized. Only a very small part of my subjectivity is what I can call what I can call myself. The rest of it is anonymous, is amorphous, as it were, is a combination of drives, desires, and so forth. In plants, clearly, that kind of individuation that we talk about when we talk about subjective I is not accentuated, so that their subjectivity is much more on the side of what we call the unconscious of the it thinks than an individuated I that thinks. Of course, again, I'm thinking here about the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. For Kant, all of my conscious representations are accompanied by this implicit assertion, I think. But at the same time, Kant, of course, did not take into account the unconscious level of subjectivity. So as soon as we take seriously the conclusions of psychoanalysis, we have to say that humans are a combination of an I think and it thinks. And this it thinks, I would claim, is a heritage that we have that has been passed on to us from other forms of life, the animal and the plant.
Mm. It's interesting because it can tip over into a new metaphysic at the altar of the plant, the silent being, the secret being, the one we wish to know more about. There is that potential, isn't there?
Yes, there is certainly a potential of sacralizing plants, and plants have traditionally played a very big role in most of world religions. And so there is a danger, I would actually claim, of sacralizing them, of adoring them, of imposing upon them a kind of sacred status. I would not want to go in this direction. I would rather like to carve a special niche of ethical respect for plants that would avoid the extremes of either their sacralization or a kind of profession of our love for plants with all kinds of activities such as plant whispering. I've heard this term recently, talking to plants and so on, which would be the analog of horse whispering, right? I would not be against people pursuing these kinds of activities, but I think philosophically it would be productive to work out this middle ground of respect between, on the one hand, our love for the vegetal world, and on the other hand, our sacralization of plants.
Mm. Nevertheless, you are critical of the 2008 Swiss Federal Commission report, which for the very first time affirmed the rights of plants in their own right. Why are you critical of what appears to be a landmark in this kind of plant thinking?
Yes, I'm critical of this report only for a very specific reason. I think that practically the report is an enormous advance on any sort of legislation that we've had thus far relating to plants. On the philosophical level, my criticism simply goes to say that the report failed to inquire into the mode of being of plants. That is, it did not really ask what plants are, what their relation to human beings could be. It operated with the pre-given, preset philosophical categories such as intrinsic value or instrumentality and so on, but did not really raise this more profound philosophical or even ontological, if you will, question of what is a plant and how in respecting plants we can actually respect a part of ourselves which we have denigrated and disavowed and have been doing so for a long time. We have to recognize another in a plant, including another that is within us. Insofar as we are living beings, we do share in the soul of plants, according to Aristotle. And so this other is not only external to us, but lives within us. And I think here an interesting question arises about the definition of a plant. Ancient Greeks did not have a word specific for plants. They called plants futoi, which were growing beings. But of course, both animals and humans are also growing beings, even though in addition to plant growth, we and the animals grow in other kinds of ways, experientially, for instance. And so to recognize the other in plants is also to recognize this vegetal other in us.
So to a practical question, what does this mean for eating plant life?
Oh, yes, this is an enormous question, and I have been grappling with it for a long time. Of course, we as humans depend on plants, and we cannot give up on using them in one way or another, whether for creating shelter or nourishment or even clothes. The problem is not that we consume plants, but that in consuming them, we try to consume something of their being. And this is what I take issue with. To give you an example, I think that there is a very telling trend now of live food, so that people want to eat things that are alive, sprouted seeds, some oysters, for instance, that are still alive. And in this kind of a drive, I think the underlying desire is to consume not just this clam or this seed, but the life principle contained in it. And this, I think, is deeply problematic. So that instead of consuming the being of these vegetal beings, the being of plants, we could actually recognize other potentialities, other possibilities that they have, possibilities that are completely unrelated to us. And once we acknowledge these possibilities and respect them to some extent, it is only then that we can come back to this question of what can we actually ethically eat and consume. But in any case, I would refrain from trying to consume the very life core, life principle, or life force somehow contained in these in this living beings that we eat, in this sense. Mm.
Well, ultimately, Michael, I guess to come to plant thinking, there has to be a continued decentering of humans to some degree. Is that the way it would have to be seen for plant thinking to properly take shape?
Yes, absolutely. And so if we have moved away now from the anthropocentric paradigm where the human is at the center of the universe and have to some extent embraced a zoocentric paradigm, at least in contemporary Western philosophy, this is now a matter of consensus, I would say, then this is not sufficient in a way. What I would advocate is a kind of phytocentric paradigm, that is, a paradigm centered on plants, but with one proviso. This paradigm centered on plants would not create a new center that would be insurpassable. Rather, to say that plants are at the center is to decenter this very new-centered paradigm. Why? Because, as I mentioned, plants as growing beings encompass both humans and animals. In fact, for ancient Greeks, the very word nature, phusis, was derived from the word for plant, phuton. And so, in this sense, to speak about plants is to speak about the whole of nature. It's a kind of paradigm that even if we zero onto it and focus on it, decenters itself. And this, I think, is its beauty. It's exactly the fact that plants are not a unified, centered existence or agents with which we can concern ourselves to the exclusion of everything and everyone else. Rather, as soon as we relate to plants, we relate through them to much more than what they are. We relate through them to animals, to humans, to the environment of which they are necessarily a part, exactly because they do not separate themselves from their milieu. They do not oppose themselves to their environment in the way that humans and animals do. So plants could be a kind of an entry point into a broader environmental ethic and a broader environmental approach that would encompass much of what we call nature.
Michael Marder from the University of the Basque Country, advancing an argument for plant thinking, a philosophy of vegetal life no less, a conversation which started many others when we first aired it. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Diane Dean, technical production today by Luke Purse and Louis Mitchell. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you for more on RN Summer next week.